Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking with you today about Parkinson's disease to start the show. About 60,000 Americans are diagnosed with it every year, and so it's not an insignificant issue that a lot of individuals and family members have to deal with. We have a couple of guests for you to talk about the disease and treatments that are available. One of the guests, they're both with Movement Disorders Program at UW Health. One is Dr. Laura Dent. Dr. Dent, thanks for joining us. Oh, appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
She's a neurologist, focuses in the care of patients with movement disorders and designing unique programs that suit their particular conditions. Addie Gasper with us as well. Addie, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
She is an adult nurse practitioner. She's certified as an advanced practice nurse in hospice and palliative care. And her background, she's got a good broad background, dietetics, neurological, and general ICU nursing, inpatient palliative care. So do you or someone you know or care about have Parkinson's? What questions do you have about treatments? What would you like to know about its symptoms? Questions or comments, you can give us a call. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. So, Dr. Dent, maybe you could start and talk about what really is Parkinson's disease. What causes it?
Yep. So Parkinson's disease is considered to be a neurodegenerative disease, meaning it affects the brain, and there's brain cells that are dying off for reasons that we don't understand. We don't know the exact cause of it. The leading theories revolve around it being some sort of genetic predisposition, and then a variety of other things might have to happen, different exposures to actually trigger the process.
So there may be some environmental factors involved here.
Correct. We don't know if it's, you know, there's been associations with pesticide exposure. Also, there could be some viral exposures or a combination of factors in the environment or that people have been exposed to that can then trigger it.
And what movement symptoms, maybe Addie Gasper, we can go to you for that. What kind of movement symptoms do we see at various stages?
Sure. Oftentimes it'll be an intermittent tremor that you'll see initially, and it'll start on one side of the body. And one of the things that we notice is that it'll be at rest. As the disease progresses, then you'll start to see that the tremor will be on the other side of the body. Might notice it in the legs as well. You'll also see rigidity, meaning stiffness throughout the body, and something that we call bradykinesia, or slow movement.
And actually, Tom emailed and wondered about stiff person syndrome. Maybe as long as you mention it, maybe we can talk about that. And Tom wants to know about treatments or any new ones that may be available.
Stiff person syndrome is a completely different disease entity.
Okay.
That is something that a different subspecialist of neurologists usually takes care of.
Okay, so it's not really Parkinson's then.
Right, right.
Okay, so is it? So treatments of that you would have to you would deal with someone else probably.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. So how are you diagnosed? What are the kind of the symptoms that first come up again?
Yeah. So oftentimes it can be tremor or a certain kind of stiffness and slowness, right? A shaking of, can be an arm or a leg. And then people will, over time, they'll feel like their limbs might be heavy. It might feel like a certain type of weakness. They'll have difficulty moving, and it's diagnosed actually by a doctor hearing the story and examining the patient. There isn't a blood test or anything like that. That's usually very helpful, MRI imaging will be normal for age. So it's really hearing and, you know, the patient's story of their symptoms, doing a good neurologic exam, which is the test for it.
So a lot of times it would be a person who, say it's your loved one, and maybe their hands are shaking or their head might be shaking.
Yep. So there can be a variety of different tremors. There's something called essential tremor that oftentimes is confused, or people have that as well. And that usually causes a head tremor. Sometimes you can have a jaw tremor or chin tremor as part of Parkinson's. But again, the classic Parkinsonian tremor is very characteristic and, relatively easy to recognize, although there's a spectrum of severities. And, at times it will be rather tricky, but it's a matter of seeing that tremor will be the most useful thing for the diagnosis.
Well, maybe you could talk a bit about your whole moving forward, or your movement. And Addie, maybe you can address that.
Sure. We have a monthly seminar, as you might call it, that we have different speakers that come in from February to November, and different physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, different people, depending on the topic. So we have different topics that relate to Parkinson's disease. It's the second Monday of every month. It starts at 6:30 p.m. And it's at the Goodman Center here in Madison in the Brassworks building, the community center. And from 6:30 to 8, we have great conversation about different topics of Parkinson's. Next month's is about palliative care with Dr. Jessica Baker. And at the end, people are able to ask questions. And in general, I think a lot of people use it as a time to socialize with other folks that have Parkinson's as well. So it's great.
That's a nice meeting area, too.
Yeah, it is.
Not far from where I live, actually. So, it's a nice setting for it. So how is your team organized, medical team organized at the UW to work with people who have Parkinson's?
Right. Well, it is. We have a very much a team approach. Are there six providers? So five neurologists and Addie. As our nurse practitioner, we have a couple of clinic nurses who will field lots of phone calls for us from our patients and are very key in helping us, manage symptoms and answer questions in between our scheduled visits. At UW, we're also very fortunate to have lots of physical therapists that specialize in Parkinson's disease, also speech pathologists that specialize in OT. We have health psychologists that are available to help as part of the team. It's truly a team effort, and we try to individualize the person's treatment to what their needs are.
Yeah.
Parkinson's disease has a huge spectrum of symptoms and severity and rates of progression, and people cope with that in a variety of ways, of course. And we try to really key in and tailor the person's care specifically to what they need.
So no magic bullet.
No, unfortunately, no magic bullet. And one recipe doesn't fit all, or one size doesn't fit all. It's quite an individual.
Tell me, what is the age range? What's the more, I suppose the more common may be older folks, but is there an age range?
There is. And so first of all, there's a very rare juvenile form of it. But most people, the average age of onset is about 65 years old. However, the range is anywhere from symptoms starting and when people are in their early to late 20s. I've diagnosed people who started to have symptoms when they were in 85 or 90. So it's really a huge span.
Yeah. And those first symptoms, depends on the person, but what are some common first symptoms?
Common first symptoms are being the tremors, very characteristic, although at least 30% of people will never have tremor or don't have the classic Parkinsonian tremor. So it's more a stiffness and slowness and finding that they're not able to move normally. And sometimes it takes a while for it to really become apparent. At first, some of the symptoms might be intermittent and come and go, and then over time they'll become more persistent and intrude more into someone's usual activities.
So aside from activities, what about a person's mental state, or how is a person's mentality affected, if that's the right way to put it?
Yeah. Some people can have cognitive effects. Usually that's more of a later finding, but they'll notice slowness of thinking or actual memory problems. Some people have mood disorders, so anxiety or depression, you know, that might occur early on. And again, that'll be highly variable.
Yeah, I would think if you're noticing your hands, you know, something physical happening to you, it's not the most uplifting thing. It would be depressing, or could be depressing,
right.
I guess, for people.
And there's a lot of research going on looking at early signs of the disease. You know, we focus on the movement signs, so like the tremor, the stiffness and slowness, but we, you know, by the time that people are experiencing that, there's been a fair amount of brain cell loss already. And so there's tons of research going on looking for early markers of the disease so that maybe we can intervene earlier in a more of a preventative type of manner.
Even though there's not a magic bullet, there are things you can do early on to help slow it down?
Well, there's not a medicine or anything that's been proven yet. However, we find that people who exercise regularly will do much better. You know, exercise has numerous obvious benefits, but there is some basic science research showing that there is possibly factors released in the brain that might help preserve those brain cells that are struggling to survive.
Oh, okay. Well, let's take some calls. If you have a question or comment or maybe an experience to share as it relates to Parkinson's, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. And Janet in Madison will take a call from you. Thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a friend who was put on a psychiatric med, and he, for all the world, has full-blown Parkinsonian symptoms since then. And can you talk about that a little bit? How often does that happen? You know, and why he would be kept on a med that would do that? It's really debilitating.
Mm-hmm. So there are some psychiatric medicines that, as a side effect, can cause what we call drug-induced Parkinson's disease or Parkinsonism. And that, you know, that can be very tricky. I can't speak, you know, to this particular person's specific care, and can't judge what another physician is doing, of course, but I'm not sure why they would, you know, continue someone on that. But it is something you could certainly recommend that they discuss that with their, you know, their doctors. You know, they can be evaluated. We often, you know, get people referred to us by psychiatrists or primary care doctors, you know, wondering about this issue of the, you know, drug-induced, or is it the garden variety idiopathic form of the disease that's becoming unmasked. It's a very complicated issue. But I would encourage you to have your friend seek evaluation for it.
So go back to that original doctor and things aren't working the way I'd hoped.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, don't stop medicine suddenly or anything, but that's certainly fair game to discuss with the doctor who's prescribing that and caring for your friend.
Makes good sense to me. Talking today with Dr. Laura Dent, neurologist at the University of Wisconsin, focuses in the care of patients with movement disorders, and Addie Gasper, adult nurse practitioner certified as an advanced practice nurse in hospice and palliative care, and talking about the movement disorders program at UW Health and Parkinson's. Again, you can join in. I think there's one open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dave Potratz, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking about Parkinson's disease today with a couple of people from the Movement Disorders Program at UW Health, Dr. Laura Dent, a neurologist, Addie Gasper, adult nurse practitioner, and they both work as within the Movement Disorders Program at UW Health. So it's great to have them along. Our lines are all filled, I believe. So let's take our next caller, Jim in Madison. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, my dad had Parkinson's for 14 years, and when he acquired it, right at the time that he acquired it, he was given a diagnosis by the doctor of possible terminal cancer, and so that and even asking him this specific question was that I asked him, do you think that you got the Parkinson's because of the diagnosis of cancer, sort of a mental or psychological trauma that he suffered? And I was wondering if your guests knew of any research that sort of addressed the psychological aspect of acquiring Parkinson's.
Okay, I bet there's some work out there in that area. Dr. Laura Dent, maybe we'll go to you first.
So we don't think that mental stress will cause Parkinson's disease itself. However, certainly if someone was prone or going to develop it, you might have some unmasking of the symptoms during a very stressful situation. So it's not unusual that people, when they've been getting a life-changing diagnosis such as, you know, cancer, or they have a surgery, or they're in a car accident, they'll say that, oh, that's when I started to really notice a tremor or whatever their symptom of Parkinson's is, but that we really don't think that was the ultimate cause of it, but it might certainly have become unmasked due to the stress that disease or that situation caused.
Would an injury, let's say a head injury in a car accident or something like that, could that lead to Parkinson's?
I don't think a single head injury would, but if people have repetitive head injuries, we're finding that that's been associated with different neurodegenerative conditions, one of which is Parkinson's. So that could be one of those triggers that I mentioned earlier that, you know, could occur in the right situation.
Yeah. All right. Jim, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give Ann in Menasha a chance to join in. Ann, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I've been struggling for several years with a very severe cervical dystonia that has not responded to treatment. And I'm just wondering if there is any correlation between a cervical dystonia and Parkinson's development later in life.
Unlikely, although we never say never in neurology. But most people with cervical dystonia, even ones that are very refractory to the standard treatments, usually that does not progress, or it's not an early marker of Parkinson's disease. The brain mechanisms that are not functioning properly in cervical dystonia, we believe to be different than what occurs in Parkinson's disease. Although some people with advanced Parkinson's disease will have, for different reasons, symptoms that resemble cervical dystonia or secondary cervical dystonia.
All right. There we go, Ann. Thank you for that question. Appreciate it. Mary in Ashland, it's your turn. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I live in Ashland, and I am a member of a Parkinson's support group, and I also have Parkinson's. And we've noticed that music as exercise can have a real positive impact on people with Parkinson's. And I was wondering what your take on this was, because we've decided to form some groups up here in the Bayfield, Ashland, Chequamegon Bay area by inviting an instructor to teach people who know dance in our area to use some of these techniques in exercise with people.
Oh, interesting. Addie, I bet you work with a lot of people in a lot of different ways when it comes to dealing with this. What about dance class?
I think that's great. One of the things that I often tell my patients is never stop moving if you can help it. And so dance is a great way to get in exercise. And, you know, the music just adds another layer of joy to it. And I think that anytime you're moving, you're getting endorphins going and also creating natural dopamine. So I think that that's a great thing to do. And there are instructors out there for cycling classes, boxing classes, Zumba, you know, those kind of things that are, you know, have instructors that are used to working with folks with Parkinson's. And so I think that that's great. Will definitely help people that go to the class. So
keep it up, Mary.
Yeah.
Keep it up. And thank you very much for calling. Well, Kathy in New Berlin has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have a friend who has Parkinson's. I also have a friend who has Lewy body. And I was wondering if you could tell me the difference between the two.
Okay. Dr. Laura, let's go to you.
Sure. So Parkinson's disease, when we use that term, usually we're referring to the garden variety disease or what we call idiopathic Parkinson's disease. And it's the classic form of the disease. But there are other diseases that can resemble it. And there's this other disease sometimes called Lewy body disease or dementia with Lewy bodies. And it's related to Parkinson's disease in many ways. However, in Lewy body disease, classically, people will have onset of some of the movement difficulties that resemble Parkinson's disease, but they'll have significant cognitive problems or dementia that will occur within a year or two of the movement symptoms. And that kind of distinguishes it as a different disease entity to us. If we look, pathologically, Parkinson's disease has this abnormality that's referred to as a Lewy body that we can see on microscopic slices of people's brains. It's a marker for Parkinson's disease, and we see it accumulating in certain parts of the brain. And somebody who has Lewy body disease, if we examine their brain, they'll have these Lewy bodies as well, but they'll be spread out in a different pattern. And this is something that we would see at autopsy. There's not a scan that we can look at. So the distinction between these two diseases is made clinically, and it's based on the history of the person's symptoms and, you know, sometimes even how they've responded to medicines and a variety of constellation of clinical signs and symptoms.
Yeah. Kathy, thanks very much for that question. Appreciate it. I want to give Carol in Black Earth a chance to join us. Hi, Carol. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yes. I have a question regarding a tremor in my left hand. I am left-handed. It's only in my left hand. It only occurs when I'm trying to write. You know?
Yeah, so we see that sometimes, of course. And there is something called writer-specific tremors or writing tremor, a very descriptive name. And sometimes that can be associated with a certain type of different type of movement disorder or something called essential tremor. Some people will have some of that when they start, if they're showing signs of early Parkinson's. It's really hard to know. It really depends on the character of those tremors. So I can't diagnose you over the phone, of course, but it would be something that would be reasonable to have a neurologist check out. Yeah. And not to be super concerned, like, oh my goodness, of course you're going to be concerned, but reasonable to talk to your primary care physician and, you know, see if there's a neurologist in your area that could evaluate that to see what can be done about it for you.
And when you go in, what is a test like? What are the tests like for that sort of thing?
Yeah, so it's, again, getting the story of the symptoms or the person's history, and then doing a neurologic exam and seeing exactly the character of this, of the shaking that she's experiencing.
Carol's experiencing.
Exactly.
So, Carol, does that help?
Yeah, it does. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Richard in River Falls, it's your turn now. Hi, Richard.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you. I'm wondering if your guest knows if Parkinson's is on the Agent Orange list of diseases that are linked to that exposure. And secondly, I have a Vietnam vet friend in Tennessee who is doing boxing. It's, of course, not human contact boxing, but he's been diagnosed with Parkinson's for several years and just started this and feels that it's been very helpful. And I'm wondering if the Wisconsin program that we're talking about has included that type of physical activity to see if it aids people with Parkinson's.
Yeah. Addie, have you worked with people using boxing therapy?
Yes, absolutely. I have several patients that do boxing programs in their counties and have great experience with it. It improves balance. It improves their overall mood. And again, just gets them, I think, interacting with other people.
So it's kind of like a shadow boxing then? Or
my understanding is, a lot of it is, I think they wear the actual boxing gloves and they do a lot of the boxing movements and hit boxing bags. And then they do a lot of, I think, stances that try to help with their balance.
Yeah, that.
But no actual, I don't think, contact.
They're
is
not
my
hitting anybody else.
No.
Nobody's hitting them.
No.
But I could see hitting a bag or something like
yes.
that, or that take out a little aggression on it at the same time. Well, what about Agent Orange, Dr. Dent?
Yes, it is on the list of exposures that that may cause Parkinson's. So, any veteran who has had Agent Orange exposure and is showing signs of Parkinson's disease really needs to reconnect or connect with their Veterans Administration, because they will get some monetary, I can't think of the term right now.
Some help with seeing physicians
exactly.
and so forth and getting treatments.
Right. And there's a benefit that will be associated with it. So it is something they definitely should go and connect with the VA about.
All right, Justin. So thank you very much for Richard, thank you so much for bringing that up. Appreciate it very much. Danelle in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Danelle.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to make this quick because I'm on the road by Rockford. But my husband suffered from cortical basal degeneration, which is a Parkinson's-like disease that's much rarer, but I'm wondering, the only thing they could do was use the Parkinson's treatment, which didn't work for him, and if he had Parkinson's, he'd probably still be alive. But is there any research, I'm going to follow it up and then I'll get off the road so I can listen, but is there any research now going into cortical basal? Because it was very frustrating for us to go to all the workshops, do all the things, talk about stem cells and know that it wasn't going to work for what Stephen had. And then the other question is, at one time, they talked about possible correlation between late life surgeries and the onset of Parkinson's. So I will take my questions off the line.
Thanks. All right. Thank you very much for calling, Danelle. So, Dr. Laura Dent?
Yeah. So regarding research for cortical basal degeneration, as she stated, it is one of the atypical Parkinsonian disorders, meaning something that might start out looking like Parkinson's disease, but then other signs and symptoms develop, and we know that it's this other disease entity. It's very rare, so it is hard to have studies for it, but there are lots of associations now that are looking into that in more detail. And, we don't know that brain trauma really predisposes to that. We really don't know the cause of that. It has a different pathologic mechanism from what we can tell. And unfortunately, it doesn't respond to the Parkinson's treatment, so it has a much worse prognosis.
Yeah. And so what about the late-life surgeries? Have you seen any research on that?
That's really a controversial area. There's always, we find out more and more things about what general anesthesia does to the brain. But there's so far, not been definitive link that a surgery is going to cause Parkinson's disease. Certainly, if someone was showing some mild, symptoms leading up to it, you know, they might become exacerbated or brought out or unmasked by a surgery. And so that's usually what we think is happening.
Yeah.
Not that
Instead
the surgery caused
it.
It's just that, oh gosh, now we're seeing it because of this stress on the body. The brain is always trying to, you know, it always compensates. And so, but if there's too many stressors for it, it can't compensate for everything.
For everything, yeah. You mentioned stem cell. I'm wondering about treatments and so forth. Is there stem cells being researched or
it
used?
Really, it is. And it's been showing some positive effects that it's still pretty much, you know, in very early stages, either, you know, animal basic science research stages or just very early human studies. And it is showing it is very promising. In saying so, though, there, I always like people to be aware that there's also something called stem cell tourism, where there's a lot of places that are saying that they're infusing stem cells, and we're not quite sure what's happening there. And, you know, it can be a way that people are trying to help, but also really taking people's money, and it's, you know, it might not be really what people think it is. So it's not, you know... It's something to be cautious of.
Something like that that might pop up online, you'd want to talk to your physician.
Exactly. Because there have been some studies coming up where some of these places have caused harm now, too.
Oh, boy.
So, you know.
Yeah. Well, with that in mind, let's turn to Mike in Portage County next. Mike, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. In the February 1st edition of Fortune magazine, there was an article about the link between the amino acid L-serine in Parkinson's and other neurological diseases. I was wondering if your guests knew anything about that research and had an opinion about it.
Dr. Dem?
Yeah, so I'm just a little bit familiar with that. I didn't have a chance to read the article that you mentioned, but it's, you know, there's lots of things that have been linked, and it's always difficult to know if it's just a... if it's a true cause or correlation. There's been many things that have been correlated with an increased link with Parkinson's disease, but that doesn't always prove cause. So those things are pretty pretty tough to study, but are undergoing extensive treatment. I mean, extensive study,
yes,
in the hope of finding a treatment that's better than what we already have.
There we go. Thank you for that call. Let's go to, let's see, who's next? Mike in Portage County, we just talked with, I believe. So let's go to Justin in Fond du Lac. Hi, Justin.
Hello.
What can we do for you today?
I was wondering if there's a connection between Parkinson's and Tourette syndrome, and if your department at UW does any work on Tourette syndrome.
All right. Thank you for calling.
So there is not a connection between Parkinson's and Tourette's. And we see people with Tourette's. I do have a handful of people who have Tourette's and Parkinson's, but they're independent. And, you know, the risk of having or if you have Tourette's syndrome, which usually starts in childhood or and can linger into adulthood or persist in adulthood, doesn't put you at increased risk of Parkinson's. But I do have a handful of people over the years I've been doing this that have had both that we can treat. There's not any research going on in the Movement Disorders Clinic regarding Tourette's at this time, but we do see people with Tourette's. Our pediatric neurologists will treat people with Tourette's, and then the adult movement disorders people will take care of people with Tourette's.
Addie, you wanted to add something in here, too.
I do. I have just a couple of patients as well that have Tourette's. And while it is a different disorder, we do use deep brain stimulation on a couple of patients for that. And it can be helpful. So it's a similar treatment, different area of the brain that we may put the leads in. But it can be very helpful for that.
So there is electronic treatments that is that one of the normal usual treatments?
Or? Not typically. These patients usually have dystonia along with it, and so the idea is the impulses in the brain to try to help with communication between the neurons to try to help with that dystonia and the Tourette symptoms.
Okay. Justin, thanks again. Appreciate it. Gerald and Rhinelander, your turn. Hi, Gerald.
Hi. About 25 years ago, my dad had Parkinson's, and his primary symptom for the first few years, at least, was hallucinations of various kinds. And once they diagnosed Parkinson's, they wanted to give him Parkinson's medications, even though he didn't have a whole lot of tremor. And that made the hallucinations much worse. And so it was a continual battle over that. Do they have medicines now that deal with that aspect of Parkinson's? I might mention also, he always had problems with general anesthesia, having, confusion for a long time, for days afterwards.
Oh. Well, I'm sorry to hear about your father, Gerald. Thanks a lot for that question. Dr. Dent, maybe you could comment.
Sure. So hearing the little bit of history you were able to give us about your dad makes me wonder if he actually had something called dementia with Lewy bodies, which is one of the Parkinsonian variants. Those patients often can hallucinate quite easily, and certain medicines can trigger that. However, we do treat people that have Parkinson's disease. Some people will develop hallucinations. Sometimes it's from the medications. Sometimes they're starting to have some cognitive changes as well. And there are some medicines out there now that, are pretty effective at treating those. Not everybody with Parkinson's disease will get hallucinations, however.
If people are interested, just before we run out of time here, on just what kinds of online help or of information, Addie, maybe you can comment on this, is available for people who wonder if their relative or if they have Parkinson's or early onset, or talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So UW on the movement disorder website has some information about movement disorders. But the American Parkinson's Disease Association also has a way for you to look up the what Parkinson's is, what are symptoms of it. And if you put in your zip code, you're able to find out support groups and other things like that in your area. But I always recommend that information, especially with new diagnosis, come from your physician. So it's really important that the neurologist that diagnoses the Parkinson's disease or movement disorder in general is the person that you ask most of the questions to, because there's a lot of information out there. But I'd always bring it back to the physician that diagnosed you.
Yeah, that makes sense. And at the beginning of the show, we were talking about your regular get-togethers.
Mm-hmm.
What? And I've forgotten already here. It's the
Moving Forward.
I know it's Moving Forward, but when is it? When are they held?
Oh, second Monday of every month between February and November.
Second Monday of every month, and its time is
6:30 to 8 p.m.
6:30 mm-hmm. to 8 p.m.
at the Goodman Community Center in the Brassworks Building.
In Madison, yeah.
In Madison.
Yeah.
And there's also a link to the past. We've filmed some of the sessions, and so there's a link to that on the UW Health Movement Disorders website that people can connect with.
And I imagine it's a long address.
Well, I think if you just were to type in uwhealth.org/movingforward, you should be able to find it.
uwhealth.org/movingforward,
correct.
Mm-hmm.
And we are moving forward. Because, and I want to thank you so much, both of you, for being with us. You're doing wonderful work.
Thank you.
I appreciate it, and I know our listeners do, too. Thank you.
Pleasure being here. Thank you.
Yeah.
Dr. Laura Dent, one of our guests, and the other guest, by the way, Dr. Dent's a neurologist who focuses in the care of patients with movement disorders. Addie Gasper, adult nurse practitioner. She's certified as an advanced practice nurse in hospice and palliative care. Wonderful to have them with us today, and we'll try and get them back, and we'll do it again sometime. Love to have them back. Thank you very much. We will move forward to the weather, which was kind of crummy, if you ask me, this morning, at least in Madison. What about your part of the state? We'll talk climate and weather with our weather guys next on the Ideas Network.